welcome Dr. Van Dam as he brings us his talk, Faith, Fusion Energy, and Federal Service.
Thank you. It's live. Ooh, it's loud, too. Okay. Very good. Good. Well, I want to thank Bob and everyone here for inviting me to this meeting, which I confess is my first time ever. It's a little embarrassing. Yes. Thanks to the program committee and its chair, my friend, good friend Bob Kaida, for working on me extensively to convince me that somebody who knows nothing about paleobiology and creation science or ethics or history of science or the philosophy of religion might actually have a few things to say that would be of interest to this audience. I hope that is the case. Here's the organization of the talk, Faith, Fusion Energy, and Federal Service, and it reminds me of the sermons that I grew up on in church that always had 3 points, preferably alliterated to be remembered. Faith, Fusion Energy, and Federal Science. A very dear Christian lady, an elderly saint, once said to me that she disliked people in the church using the word but, B-U-T. As in, I know the scripture says this, but I think I'm going to live this way instead. And I agreed with her on that point, and then pointed out a very glorious use of the word but in scripture in Ephesians chapter 2. But God, who is rich in mercy, out of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead through our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. There's a famous sermon by this Welsh medical doctor who became a preacher and teacher, Dr. Lloyd Jones, on this verse. And the title of the sermon was, But God. But God. So even though in this talk I'm going to refer to some personal things about myself, I would like you to keep in mind that I and you, all of us, we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk therein. So the focus is on God. It's not on me, it's on God. So I was traveling in Japan recently on business. My wife came along. We went to church on the weekend. And as part of the worship service, a lady got up and told us her akashi, which is a testimony, how she came to know the Lord, how she joined that church. And since you don't know me, and you'd like to perhaps calibrate where I come from and what I think, let me give you a very brief akashi. So I had the blessing of being brought up by Christian parents who made me go to church twice every Sunday. Very fortunately, by the time I came along, the Dutch language afternoon service had been canceled and sent me to Sunday school and sent me to weekly Monday night catechism class. So I memorized the Heidelberg Catechism, became familiar with the Belgian Confession and the Canons of Dort and all that good stuff. And they sent me to Christian schools from kindergarten right through college, which was Calvin College. And so I did all this, and at the age of 18, along with my entire catechism class, went before the elders and made profession of faith. And a month later realized I was not a Christian. And I went off to Calvin, and I was struggling with this. It was difficult. And I think maybe the second summer, I was out of town working in Flint, Michigan at a General Motors research laboratory because I had a scholarship. And so then I went to church. There was a little Christian Reformed church. One of the members was a physicist. And as I said, I was struggling with Christianity. God was inconvenient. I was more interested in myself, but I just couldn't put it away. And finally, this is the work of the Holy Spirit, but I realized I could not get past the historical fact of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the Apostle Paul explains the importance of this in 1 Corinthians 15. Christ is risen from the dead. Christ has become the first fruits of them that slept. Another book that helped me very much was Basic Christianity by John Stott. And you remember it by University Press. In the introduction, before he even begins chapter 1, he says, "Don't read this book and then just put it down. When you come to the end of this book, make a decision, one way or the other." And if I point out here, King James and then the Phillips version. So when I grew up, it was King James. I memorized chapters and verses out of King James. The church changed to the American Standard Version, the old one, still "thee, thou speaketh" and all that good stuff. And when I came across the J.B. Phillips translation / paraphrase, it was like a revelation. You know, I could understand what was being said. And this is where I was then at that point. Come close to God. He will come close to you. You can read the rest of this verse. It is a description of repentance. And so what happened was, here's Dr. Don DeGraff. He's now retired. He was at the University of Michigan Flint campus, the satellite campus in Flint. He may have been the first professor of physics there. And he was in this church where I just happened to be that summer that I was struggling with these questions. I looked up on the internet. He's written some books, one on Christianity, Questions of Christian Conduct. He's also written a physics book. And that year, after realizing that the resurrection of Jesus was real and true, I went to see him. He was at his house. He had another person visiting, and he was catechizing that person using Matthew 25, talking about Jesus, the Son of Man, coming, sitting on his throne, and dividing the sheep on his right hand and the goats on his left. And I waited. The person finished and left. And he said, "What do you want to talk about?" And I said, "Well, I'm afraid I'm a goat, and I want to be a sheep." And so we talked and prayed, and really from that time forward is when my true Christian life began. He encouraged me to go to Mackinac Island, the university camp up there, every day, Bible study, group Bible study, and lectures and teaching from the Word, and I just ate it up. And something remarkable happened when I went back to my home church in Kalamazoo, Michigan. The minister there had suddenly become the most amazingly interesting preacher. And I don't know how that was, because I'll tell you a little bit about him. A very learned man. He preached for 50 minutes, no notes, right from his head. And I still go online and I pull up his notes from sermons that people have written down. He's gone to be with the Lord now. And I use them as reference material. It was very great insight into Scripture. But he preached in a monotone. And he started very soft. And he was preaching away very softly. And the janitor in the back would crank up the microphone. And then about 10 minutes later, he'd be normal. And then about 20 minutes later, he was loud. And then they'd crank him back down again. Monotone the whole way through. And so before this conversion experience, I developed an expert technique at just sitting there quietly, daydreaming, not listening. But I came back, and suddenly I realized that this man knew the Bible, and the Bible was speaking. The Bible was living and active, and it was for me. Well, as I said, I was at Calvin. I had the great blessing of having some really outstanding physics profs who taught me there. You may know some of their names. Vern Ehlers was a physics prof, and then he decided to go into politics, Michigan State Legislature, Michigan State Senate, and then the U.S. Congress for 18 years. And when I was at the University of Texas, I'd go to visit him, and he often encouraged me, "Why don't you think about working for the federal government?" And I said, "Well, I'll think about it." And then when I finally did it, he up and retired. Roger Gerfune, Al Krominga was someone I really grooved on because he was a theorist. And so we worked together on various kinds of things. And I wanted to be a nuclear physicist because of him. And I went to Berkeley because of Vern Ehlers. Professor Menninga is in the audience. Right there. My wife took a course from you Howard Van Til, I think you know him. He was even a member of the executive committee of the ASA, and John Van Zytel, someone else. So we had a rather good physics education. Let me change gears and talk about the second F. What is fusion? Am I standing in the way of people here? Okay, fusion is not the automobile made by the Ford Motor Company. Anybody have a Ford Fusion? It's not fusion music. It's not fusion cuisine. I've even seen fusion candy because they mix up various colors and tastes. I'm talking here about taking light nuclei and combining them together into a heavier nuclei, and in the process, releasing energy. Because this is God, how God set up the universe, with this binding energy curve. So fission is over here with uranium, heavy element. You split it, you move down the binding energy curve, and you release some energy. We know how that works. Iron is the most stable element in the world. But on this side, if you take hydrogen and hydrogen and put them together and get helium, you release energy, and it's the curve is very steep there. So it's a huge amount of energy coming out, which is great. Except that to get to that point, you have to have these two nuclei collide and stick. They're both positively charged, so they repel each other until they get very, very close, and then the nuclear force takes in and they stick together. Now, something here with a question mark. Okay, you know, if you play tennis, you think of the verse in Genesis about Joseph serving in the court of Pharaoh. And as a fusion physicist, I think about this verse in 2 Peter, where it talks about the day of the Lord, the coming judgment, and the elements that will melt with fervent heat. Okay. So a small pickup truck full of fusion fuel is equivalent to a railroad car load of fission fuel, is equivalent to 10 million barrels of oil, is equivalent to 21,000 railroad car loads of coal. So you see the tremendous scale of energy that comes out in from fusion, and that's why it is so interesting indeed. So as I said, these nuclei have to collide, and the only way they can overcome the repulsive force is to be at very high energy, which requires high temperatures. In fact, the temperatures are like 100 million degrees, hotter than the core of the sun. And at those high temperatures, the electrons just break off from the atom. And so you have positive nuclei floating around with electrons running around. And this soup of charged particles is called plasma, sometimes called the fourth state of matter. Well, plasma is a lot of different places. It's mostly in outer space, in the universe, stars, supernovae, quasars, interstellar space. In fact, we like to say that 99.9% of the, now we have to say visible universe because of dark matter, is plasma of some form or another. The sun is a big ball of plasma. Plasma is less frequent on Earth, but if you go out past the atmosphere, you get to the ionosphere and the magnetosphere, that is full of plasma. Lightning bolts are plasma, albeit very short-lived. Fluorescent lights, we don't have any in this room, but there's a small plasma inside. The gas is activated, it drops back down to ground state, it emits, and there's a very weak plasma inside that. And the aurora borealis and the aurora australianis are actually plasmas. Particles come from the sun, come in the backside of the Earth, come up the field lines, hit the poles, and you get this spectacular display of plasma. So here's a diagram with density and temperature, and you can see various kinds of plasmas. The aurora, outer interstellar space, fluorescent lights. This is the low temperature, low density regime. And then up at very high temperatures, you get these magnetic fusion reactors, which I'll be talking mostly about, something called ITER, International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. And up in the same regime, but at even higher densities, is this facility which has been built out at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory called the National Ignition Facility. And it does not use magnetic fields like ITER does. It doesn't use anything to confine the plasma except its own inertia. You hit it with these, you know, multitude of laser beams, and the stuff stays there long enough and compresses in the process that you can try to get fusion. You notice, by the way, this tremendous range over a million, a scale of a million, from 10 to the second to 10 to the eighth in temperature, and in density, 10 to the 30 orders of magnitude difference. So there's all kinds of plasmas in all kinds of places in the universe. And this regime here, this kind of shaded light green regime, for a long time it was thought that there's no plasma there, at least not classical plasmas like we know and love. But more recently, we are doing experiments at Stanford, the SLAC laboratory, Linear Accelerator Laboratory. They have built a LINAC coherent light source that produces X-rays. Very long thing. It's like a mile long. And we have an end station on that, which is looking at plasmas into this regime called warm, dense matter. It's a new kind of plasma. So I went off to Berkeley to start my graduate education. And what they did was, of course, I'm taking courses. And meanwhile, they have these little afternoon seminars, each group, nuclear physics, relativity, high energy, and so forth. They have these afternoon seminars. They invite all the beginning first-year grad students to come in, listen what they're doing, and then at the very end of the seminar, the professor will say, and by the way, we have space for one or two new graduate research assistants. If you're interested, please apply. So I went to that, and by the way, I have the distinction of being rudely awakened by a Nobel Prize winner. I was sitting in one of these seminars, and Professor Luis Alvarez, who won the Nobel Prize for high energy physics, was talking about the work that his group did. I had been up all night long working electricity and magnetism problems from J.D. Jackson's textbook. Those are unbelievably difficult. You know, I just worked all night long on that. You know, it's in the afternoon, it's after lunch, and I dozed, and he stopped his talk, came over, and woke me up. Well, anyway, one of the things I learned from these seminars and talking to other students more advanced was pick an area that has a lot of connections. And I'm happy to tell you that plasma physics uses, of course, E&M, which in undergraduate at Kelvin was a subject I hated, and now I do it for a living. Mechanics, StatMech, numerical analysis, quantum, solid state, you know, all kinds of physics, and connections to all kinds of areas. Low temperature plasmas include such things as plasma TVs and more. I'll show you a picture a little bit later. It includes space plasma physics, so you send up rockets and satellites, you have to worry about plasma effects. Geophysical fluid dynamics. In the ocean, you have these whirlpools and other things, and the dynamics are exactly the same as for tornadoes and hurricanes, and in a plasma when you have turbulent vortices, all the same thing. Laser interactions, I've talked about that already. Metamaterials, you can actually focus things using a plasma to smaller than the usual focal length. Of course, we use a lot of very high-performance computing. Nonlinear dynamics, where you have all these mapping and stochastic kinds of ergodic behavior, nuclear engineering. A very new field is something called plasma medicine. And at the most recent American Physical Society meeting, I saw a textbook on this subject, which means it's made it. It's for real. And I'll give you one example that using a plasma, you can activate water to have medicinal properties. And if you put that on wounds, it actually heals very fast. And so this is quite a nice thing. And of course, fusion energy. Well, just very briefly, I think I've talked about this already, but to confine this plasma while you're building it up to go into fusion, you can use magnetic fields, you can use nothing, just big lasers, and the third example is you can use gravity, but then you need to have a laboratory that's the size of the sun because it's a fairly weak force, so that's not too practical. This is the main magnetically confined device that we are interested in just because the results are so much better. It's called a tokamak. T-O comes from toroidal, M-A-K comes from magnetic, and C-A, K-A is chamber. This is from a Russian word, so that's how they get this. It's put together. And, you know, I don't need to explain all this, but basically a time-varying current is run through there, which generates a current this way. It's an induction machine, which sets up a field, and then there's a second field as well. So there's two fields, one going this way, one going that way, and it holds the plasma amazingly well. So just to tell you the advantages, the fuel for fusion is not localized in certain countries of the world which have security issues. It's fairly widely available, and there's a big supply of it. It has almost zero, you know, CO2 footprint. It will not run away, as opposed to a fission reactor. It does not produce weapons-grade material, so there's no proliferation threat. And the radioactive wastes, yes, there are some, but they're very short-lived. Usually within 100 years or less, it's activation level, something or other, where you can just, you know, put it in a building and leave it. There are disadvantages. It's not small. It's not cheap. It's not simple. And it's not yet. This is just a little historical summary of how this whole field developed. And many scientists around the world for decades have considered this one of the so-called grand challenge problems, confining a self-burning, self-sustained fusion plasma. So it goes way back to 1928, and you see some very famous names here, Oliphant, George Gamow, Hans Bethe, who won the Nobel Prize for explaining the solar power cycle in terms of fusion. Then in the 50s, we go into this dark era where everything became classified, and there was work both in the Soviet Union and the United States and in the UK and in France on developing the H-bomb. And the professor I worked for at the University of Texas and in Princeton was involved in that project, and he told me, he said he did it because he was so afraid of Stalin. He thought Stalin was a monster. And when that was no longer the case, then he switched over to the peaceful applications of this. So it was classified for a while. The tokamak, by the way, was invented in Russia. And then in 1958, everything was unclassified. The windows were thrown wide open. Everybody shared all of their information. 10 years later, the Russian tokamak results came out. They were so outstanding, everybody just ran after that. And there's been this explosion in research ever since then in many countries around the world. This is that conference in 1958. And when you think about it, it was the second United Nations conference on peaceful uses of atomic energy. They wanted to do peaceful things like excavating large holes in the ground by setting off an H-bomb. There was an idea in California to build a rocket ship and basically propel it off the Earth by using action-reaction H-bombs, right? And they finally figured out it would take a very massive plate to protect the rocket ship, and they gave up the idea. But anyway, at this meeting, whose proceedings came out in a three-volume set, very large set, and I've read most of those when I was a graduate student at UCLA, and the papers are just, the insights are amazing. There were 5,000 scientists from 67 countries, 900 correspondents, which I presume means newspapers and radio and TV and all that, and then observers from industrial companies, 3,600. So you add that up, it's like 10,000 people at a conference that was sort of the Woodstock of nuclear fusion. And this large number of papers, but anyway, the point is, this was the beginning of the modern worldwide fusion energy research program, emphasizing collaboration, which we have been doing now for over a half a century, very freely exchanging information, people going back and forth, working here and there, and the awareness of the potential benefit of fusion for everybody in the world. These are photographs I took 50 years later, in 2008. This conference, the Fusion Energy Conference, sponsored by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which also sponsored that second United Nations conference. This is the descendant of that conference, so to speak, and it's been going on I'm sorry, you can hardly read it. It's the 22nd such conference. So it's been going on every other year for 50 years. They missed a couple years, I think, because of some political problems. Anyway, so they went back to Geneva, Switzerland, that building, which is this building, the same building where the initial meeting was held. And here you see the inside of that building. It's a very beautiful building. This is in Switzerland. I was so thrilled. I don't know if you can see it or not, but this is Mont Blanc peering over the top there. And this compares then and now. So in 1958, you see all the people. It's inside this building, beautiful building. 2008, you see the people inside the same building. They've changed the paint scheme a little bit. And for some reason, this beautiful mural was painted over. I really don't understand. So that was a great celebration. Now, going back to fusion. So you have these two hydrogen nuclei. And the best ones to use are double hydrogen and triple hydrogen, deuterium, tritium. Deuterium, you can get it out of seawater. In fact, there are companies, I know one company in Korea that's already taking deuterium out of seawater. Tritium, you use lithium and a reaction, and you can breed it, no problem. And the result, D plus T equals hydrogen nucleus. If you don't want to use it for fusion, you can use it in balloons. But you do want to use it for fusion because this is a charged particle. Helium nucleus is called an alpha particle. And because it's charged, you can hold it in with magnetic fields. And that becomes the fuel for sustaining the reaction without any input power from the outside. The only difficulty is you also get a neutron, which is not charged. It goes out. You can convert some of its energy through a thermal cycle. But in the process, of course, it hits the walls that surround the plasma, does some damage, and so forth. And it's carrying 80% of the energy, 20%, 80%. That factor of five, I'll show you on the next page. But the reason for using this reaction is as follows. It happens the highest, right there, cross-section. So it looks the biggest as they merge, is for DT compared to other reactions. And it happens at the lowest energy. So it's the easiest one to do. So we are fixated on DT plasma fusion at the moment. Okay. If you compare how much power you put in and how much power you get out, that ratio is called this Q factor, the energy fusion energy gain. And the power coming out from fusion reaction is, as I said, because 80% goes out with a neutron, you only keep 20%. There's this factor of 5 here. And then you define how much are the alpha particles actually heating the plasma. That's this fraction F sub A. And you get this table, which I've made here. So Q equals 1 is called break even, but it's not really a burning plasma yet. You need this factor of 5. And so there is a machine coming along. We've done this already, but there is a machine coming along called ITER, which will do not just Q equals 5, but Q equals 10. So it will really get into this new frontier science regime and let us look at all these new interesting phenomena. So we've been marching up this diagram here, and yellow is where we want to go, ignition, where you don't need any kind of external power for the system. So as I said, we've gotten our feet wet already, both in the U.S. and in Europe. Europe had this big machine called the Joint European Torus. Well, it totally disappeared. Okay. There was a peak that went up to 16 megawatts on this diagram. Sorry, the PDF kind of washed it out. But in the US, we had a machine. It didn't quite get that high. It got up to about 11 megawatts, Q about 0.2. But a tremendous amount of physics was done on this machine. Now, this was at the laboratory where Dr. Bob Kaida is a scientist, and I think you worked on this machine, right, TF? You did indeed. Okay. It was actually closed down in 1997 or 1998. This was kind of an end-of-lifetime experiment. But during these 4 years, they ran 1,000 discharges and collected a huge amount of information about all kinds of physics topics that we need to know about to make the next step. So this just tells you, over the decades, the progress that fusion has been making, that's the blue curve, in terms of what's called this triple product, invented by a physicist, Dr. Lawson. N is the density. You need enough of these things together. T is temperature or energy. They have to be high enough energy to smash together and fuse. And tau is the time for holding this soup together to make fusion happen. And as you can see, we've been going up, up, up. The red line is the so-called Moore's law in semiconductors, the computer performance. And that's been going up and up and up, and we're tracking right along. We need about another factor of 6 for fusion. So we are just about here, and we are moving up to this place, ETER, going up this path. There is another path as well. So we haven't gotten into burning plasmas. We are ready to do it. And we are now taking that step with this big new program called ETER. Okay, before I discuss ETER, let me tell you about the U.S. Fusion Energy Program, which is where I now work. This is energy use around the world. I heard a very interesting talk this morning, how much energy is being used in the world. And just to make the point that the Department of Energy program that supports this field of research supports not only fusion energy science, per se, but also supports what is called general plasma science, so lower temperature, other kinds of applications, space physics, astrophysical plasmas, low temperature plasmas, and the like. And there's a large diversity of institutions that are involved in this research. So the black squares are national laboratories, for example, Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and so forth. Red dots are university groups, and you can see they're all over the place. This is where I used to be, right here. And industry are the green triangles. And in fact, our program is unique around the world, actually, in having our largest fusion device in an industrial R&D laboratory, General Atomics in San Diego, California. And I think it's actually a good thing, because they bring a lot of industrial-style planning. And also, eventually, if we get to the energy application, we want to commercialize this and have companies be involved. So here in one page is the entire U.S. program. So I made this, to show you on one page. We have to be ready to give so-called elevator speeches. You're downtown, you run into somebody, hey, what's going on with fusion? Boom, boom, boom. You 30 seconds, you got to spit it out. So anyway, here's the program. Experimental, theory, diagnostic development, which are these very clever ways to look inside plasmas and see what's going on, and very strong international collaborations, as well as development of new technologies and the materials that are needed to hold these very hot and neutron-rich plasmas. But then likewise, as I said, general plasma science, which we do in a partnership with the National Science Foundation. And this center, the Max Planck Princeton Center, is a new center at Bob's laboratory, where the German Max Planck Society came over and said, we want this collaboration. And finally, the upper left is something called high energy density plasmas, and that's laser plasma interaction, very high compression, and this area that I called warm dense plasma as well. Here's one more slide that shows you every facility, experimental facility that we support. In magnetic confinement, we have the three biggies. The one, D3D, is at General Atomics in San Diego. NSTX upgrade is at Princeton. Alcator CMOD is at MIT. ETER, of course, is the big 600-pound gorilla. General plasma science facilities, I've just given a few examples here, one at UCLA, one at Princeton. Mid-size experiments, and I give an example from University of Wisconsin. And then facilities where we are not the landlord, we don't operate and pay for the facility, but we get time on it and we use it. Facilities such as the National Ignition Facility, Sandia Z machine, Rochester, University of Rochester, Los Alamos, and this one at SLAC that I already mentioned. Okay, here's the slide that I promised about low-temperature plasma science. This is courtesy of a center that we support, Center for Predictive Control of Plasma Kinetics, Multiphase and Bounded Systems. It's a big mouthful. It means low-temperature plasmas, and they're being very careful to do basic research and not get into the commercial applications, which then, you know, have problems with proprietary information and all that. And they're being very successful. It's at the University of Michigan with many partners at other universities. And they made up this picture with numbers. And so you have to look at number one, which is clearly a plasma TV. They're going out of style a little bit, but they're, you know, new things. And then the plasma TV shows a picture of a jet airplane whose turbine blades are plasma coated for, you know, toughness and reliability. And then we go over here, number three is a clearly a microwave in your kitchen. And lo and behold, plasma manufactured LEDs are in the panel, the front panel of the microwave. Number four is over here. It's referring to this gentleman's eyeglasses. And lo and behold, his lenses have, with a chemical vapor deposition process, the glass has been coated. Number five is down here. You wonder, what in the world is going on? Plasma ion implanted artificial hip. So there's all kinds of uses for plasmas in various ways. And these are low temperature, low density plasmas, but very useful. So we have collaborations around the world. And these are just some of the newer machines that we have collaborations on. This is in Korea. This is in China. This one is in India, Germany, and in England, Europe, and finally ITER, and another one in Germany over there. So we've been doing this a long time. And with Japan, in fact, I ran this exchange program when I was at Texas for about 20 years, the theory part of it. And a couple of years ago, we celebrated the 30th anniversary of this collaboration program. We have gotten along so well with the Japanese, and they have a fantastic fusion program. Excellent facilities, huge amounts of computer time. They can't even use it all. But not enough people. And so they love it when we go over there, and they come over to our institute. And, you know, the young people become the senior leading people over this 30-year period. In fact, we worked so well together with them that for 8 years, even though the agreement had expired for some legal reasons, we just kept on doing the collaborations. And this year, it was finally the lawyers figured out something, and it was renewed. Now, one of the important things, and I think this is important for us as Christians, but as scientists as well, and that is to keep an eye on the younger people, the younger scientists, the younger people also in the church who are coming up, and you want to train them for positions of responsibility. And so we have various programs in the National Fusion program to support this, such as this program, National Undergraduate Fellowship. It's actually run at Princeton, and undergraduates are brought in. They get a week of lectures. Then they go out to labs, universities. Some stay at Princeton. They do research for the summer. They write it up. And they are guaranteed travel money to go to the American Physical Society meeting in November and present their work as a poster. So that's really great. There are graduate fellowships. There are postdoctoral fellowships. The early career awards are for, like, junior faculty on the way to tenure, or now also includes junior scientists at national laboratories so that they will get a regular staff position and stay there. So I like to say that we care for our people from, you know, cradle to grave. This was actually a talk that I gave last year at APS. Now, ITER. ITER is the next frontier for our field. Originally, the name came from International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor. It's an acronym. And maybe people got a little freaked out with the word thermonuclear. So now they explain that ITER comes from the Latin word ITER, which means the way or the road. This is the way that we are going. And it is a rather large facility. Here you see the standard slightly less than 2 meter person. And this is not all of it, of course. Surrounding this thing are huge heating systems and vacuum systems and diagnostics. And it's a very, very big system that we're talking about here. So, in fact, this shows you, this is the largest tokamak in the world right now. It's in jet. And ITER is enormous compared to that. The volume of the plasma will be 10 times. The pulse length will be 10 times. The fusion power will be like 30 times. So this is a big step forward, and we are waiting for it. I don't want to get into the details, but just this red donut in here is the plasma. It's held with magnetic fields, which are then surrounded by the cryostat because it's superconducting, and it's enormous. You see this scale 30 meters here. And by the way, here is the standard person. Somewhat intimidating. Now let me tell you just a little history why ITER is being built in Europe, in particular in France. So there was a bidding process, and unfortunately the U.S. did not get involved in this, but there was an excellent bid from Japan to site it at an existing nuclear site way up in the northern part of the main island. There was a bid from Spain, there was a bid from France. The Europeans got together, knocked heads, and they decided that France will be their bid and Spain will be where they put their headquarters. You know how politics works, right? And Canada had a very interesting bid, which would have been, of course, right next to the U.S. It's just a little ways outside of Toronto, which is a wonderful city. I think there are some people from the Hamilton-Toronto area here. It's just a great place. But that didn't go too far. And so finally, it was this bid against the Japanese bid, and they went into a closed room and they reached a deal. And it's going to be built in France, in this little tiny village called Cataraches. As you're driving through, if you blink, you miss it. But that is where the French government has its big national nuclear laboratory, research laboratory. It's being built right next to it. So there's this big research laboratory right here, and it's being built directly next to that. So when we go, we fly to Paris, fly down to Marseille, take a bus, take another bus, and we're there. It is an international project with 7 members. Europe is the host, and so they pay 5/11 of the cost. The other partners, Japan, Russia, US, Korea, China, and India, are so-called junior partners, and they each pay 1/11 of the cost, 9.09%. This was the signing ceremony after they decided where to build this thing. It was done in Paris in 2006. So there are these 7 partners, members, countries, except Europe, which of course is 27 countries, and they together represent more than 50% of the world's population. It has physics goals, it has technology goals. You want to see a plasma that's dominated by alpha particle heating. You want to have high Q. You want to demonstrate certain technologies. You want to demonstrate breeding and so forth and so on. And this is the way it looks. It's a huge site here. This building, this very, very long building up here, is about 3 football fields in size. And it's to construct the coils that go around the donut the long way. Those are just too huge, too large to build, say, in another country and ship to France. You just can't do it. So they are being built on site. All of the other components, mostly, are being built here and there, Korea, Russia, US, Japan, and so forth. And then they will be shipped and assembled and put together. This hole in the ground, which is this thing right here, is where the tokamak will actually be situated. And you can have access from the bottom as well as the sides and the top. And these things, you see this, they're all pointing toward the center. Those are like seismic shock absorbers. So if the ground moves a little bit, the facility does not. And then there will be a hot cell over here because it is a radioactive facility. This is the headquarters building. It's finished. This is where people have their offices. And there's a little bridge that will go straight across to the control room. Every time I go there for a meeting, they give us a tour. And one thing that they started doing, which is very nice, again, goes back to this theme of raising up the next generation, and that is they have an international school. It moves around the world. We hosted it in Texas in 2010, and the next year it was in France, and the next year it was in India, and the U.S. actually provides scholarships for our students to go there. And I've seen already in just this couple of years, the students who went there as grad students are now postdocs and junior scientists, and they're already leading the field in certain areas. So I heard a talk this morning about world energy use. It's going up. It's probably going to double. We're going to keep using fossil fuels. There are climate changes involved. We need some serious R&D on this, for sure. And there's a lot of solutions, and just very briefly, well, we could turn off the lights, the air conditioning, not use our cars, probably not acceptable. We could improve efficiency. That is certainly a way we should do. Use more renewables. Get over our fear of fission in spite of the Fukushima Daiichi accident, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island. Get a good design. Use it carefully. Make sure that human error is minimized. And bring fusion into the mix. And very likely, we will need some kind of a hybrid portfolio of many different options in the future. This is just a quote from a book published last year, and they are predicting that in the short term, the next couple of decades, the world energy scenario will still be dominated by fossil fuels, which are gradually running out. Nuclear fission and renewables will take an increasing share. Fusion energy will establish itself through experiments like ITER and its follow-on called DEMO, demonstration reactor. And in the long term, fusion power is likely to become commercial and play an increasingly dominant role. So this is kind of the goal. I stole this from a Japanese brochure. They show a city. All looks very nice. And it's called the city that uses fusion energy. Now, again, I want to change subject. And excuse me, but I'll talk about myself a little bit, how I got into this business. So I started out at Calvin College. I went to Berkeley. And then at Berkeley, got a fellowship from the Rotary Foundation to study in Japan for a year. There was a particular personal reason I wanted to do that, so off I went to Japan and spent several months in Tokyo because the fellowship paid for some language study, and then moved to the city of Nagoya, about in the middle of Japan here, where they make the Toyota automobiles. Anybody have a Toyota besides us? And the National Institute for Plasma Physics was there at the university. And I studied with a professor. And then, actually, he became a friend. And we had him at Texas several times with his wife. He's no longer with us. He was a Roman Catholic, actually, which is unusual in Japan. And we still visit his wife when we go to Japan. Then came back to the U.S., but did not go back to Berkeley. I went to UCLA because in Japan, I met a professor from UCLA who insisted I transfer and work with him, which I did, and graduated, and then moved cross-country, as Bob said, to the Institute for Advanced Study, intending to be there for at least 2 years, but the professor I worked with suddenly was recruited by the University of Texas to start this new institute. So ended up in Texas, which I would never have thought of for a million years, but it's a great place. It really is a great place. And then more recently moved to the U.S. Department of Energy. Now, the reason I'm showing this is because my wife often makes the following point. But before I make that point, this is the man that I worked with at Princeton at the Institute for Advanced Study and then at Texas. And then after about 7 years, he left Texas and went to work for this big international project, ITER, as their chief scientist. His name is Marshall Rosenbluth, and he first studied high energy physics. Then he was in the national security business, he was one of the primary people that made the H-bomb for the U.S. I could tell you stories about that. And then he basically almost started the field of plasma physics. And here he is at the blackboard. You see all kinds of equations and a pipe. He always had a pipe. How am I doing time-wise? Okay. And you can't see it, but this is a dog-eared piece of paper. And he'd come in the morning, and he'd say, well, here's some calculations I did over the evening, 2 pages. It'd take me a week to understand the genius of something that he had done. And anyway, I really like working with him. He gave a talk once where he said this yearn to burn means fusion, is well motivated. Most of us came into the fusion program with this dream, and the dream persists. But now here's the point that my wife makes. As we and I, you know, moved around here and there, it's really a history, as you look back, of faith and church service. So I started out at Calvin and grew up in this church. I've already told you about Reverend Vanderkam, his monotone sermons that were so interesting. And then at Berkeley, I was a typical student. I kept my membership back here and visited various churches. Some of you may know Reverend Palmer, who moved up to Seattle. Reverend Richard Lewis, Orthodox Presbyterian Church. His son is an elder in the church that we are now members of in the Washington, D.C. area. And then, next. Oops. What happened? Got it. Okay. So in Japan, while I was in Tokyo, I worshipped at this church, Yokohama Reformed Church, Reverend Fuji. In Nagoya, the Yagoto Reformed Church, Reverend Sugiyama. He pastored the church that his father had started and been at for many decades, and then at some point he decided to go into home missions. He moved up to Hokkaido to start a church up there. And then back to UCLA, we were in a church that was in it was right next to Watts area, so it was an African-American church. The Princeton Presbyterian Church, I think Bob was a member of that church for a while. In Austin, we got there, and we just couldn't find a good church. We found a Bible study. We got involved in home missions, planting a church, and it grew and was a great experience. And now we're in the D.C. area, where our pastor, by the way, has a Ph.D. in microbiology and then felt called to go into the ministry. Now, I want to tell you about these people. Reverend Fuji was the pastor at the Yokohama Reformed Church, where I worshipped when I was in the Tokyo area. And he grew up in the Ise area, which is where the big shrine of Shintoism is. And he became a Christian, and his father kicked him out of the family. And he would have inherited the family estate because he was the eldest living son. And he became a pastor. And his wife, shown here, was essentially an orphan. And to make a long story short, was informally adopted by an American missionary lady, unmarried, working in Japan, who raised her. And so she liked hamburger a lot better than sushi. They got married, they had three sons, a family, and the war came along. And they lost all three sons during an American bombing raid. So after the war, when they got back together, they had no family. But the Lord was gracious and gave them a daughter, shown here, and then two more sons. And he pastored several churches. He taught at the seminary. This was the last church that he pastored. It was in Yokohama. It was in a piece of property in kind of a V-shaped between two streets. So the architect made the church narrower and narrower toward the pulpit area, but the ceiling came up, and people called it the Noah's Ark Church. Anyway, he went to be with the Lord. This was his funeral service. And probably by this time you're wondering, how do I know so much about these two people? It's because I am their son-in-law. And this is his grave. This was a family picture taken when we convinced Mom to come live with us in Texas, and she did that for 14 years, and had an opportunity at some point to go to Cincinnati, Ohio, and see the grave of her adopted mother, Miss Jessie Riker, who is shown over there in that black and white photo. And you'll notice something. She is now with the Lord as well and buried here as well with her husband. And you'll notice something about these tombstones. This is a public cemetery. It's very difficult to be buried in Japan if it's not Buddhist. But this one opened, and there was a lottery, and the Lord gave Mom this place. But you'll notice every tombstone is black except this one. That's a Christian tombstone. And on it is written this verse from Psalm 23, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, I was going to talk about federal service. How's my time going, Bob? Well, okay. I think believers can contribute in this area. Here's some examples. Sometimes it's said that when you're young, you do research, and then you do management, and then you do science policy, and then you do philosophy. I've done the first three. I don't think I'm smart enough to do the last. There are some big differences between academia and the federal government. The federal government job is the only one where, when I started, the first day, I had to take an oath. And there's a lot of security. By the way, thank you so much for this badge at this meeting. It makes me feel right at home. I need a badge to get in the parking lot, in the building, to get on my computer, all this kind of good stuff. And by the way, this is the regular federal regalia, white shirt, tie, coat. Unscheduled deadlines, lots of meetings, plan far ahead, teamwork, delegation. There's all these things that we do, but we just do a lot more of it. And the people I have found that work for the federal government are very motivated by the purpose of being of service to the country. And if you look at this later, you can see this is one of my program managers. He's a young guy. He's very excited to work in our office for the federal government. These are some verses that I have thought about over the years that help me in, particularly in management kinds of things. Abstain from all appearance of evil. We have to be so careful in the federal government to avoid conflict of interest. For 12 months, I could do nothing related to the University of Texas. Even now, I can sign procurement packages, but I have to be very careful. You have to be able to explain everything you do, any decision you make. I love this verse, whoever meddles in a quarrel, not his own, is like one who takes a passing dog by the ears. I was teaching a course on Proverbs recently for our Sunday school class, and I was thinking, yeah, just because I could do something and I see a problem, I should stand off and let my program manager handle it. That's his job, and he can do it, or she. Quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. This is what you do when you go to an elders meeting, but this is also what I do in the many meetings in the federal government. When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoso restrains his lips is prudent. So I try to be pithy, and these are slides taken from one of my program managers, Sean Finnegan, who set himself the objective of no more than 6 words per PowerPoint slide. And he achieved it in his first slide, which has now become a classic in our office. The elephant's backside, the little girl sitting next to it. You wonder, what's going on? And then in the next slide, there's a question mark added. And then he finally gets to the point that a certain percentage of the experimental work on this device is being funded by us for a certain purpose, and onward and forward. A few more verses. The man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day. Naomi speaking to Ruth about Boaz, and I had this by my desk for many, many years to encourage me, get it done now. Other people depend on it. In an abundance of counselors, there is safety, another verse from Proverbs. And in fact, at one of our recent peer review meetings where you bring in a panel of people and they look at proposals and they rate them and judge them and so forth, evaluate them, I quoted this verse, but I didn't give them the reference. We have federal advisory committees that are very important to give advice, and they have to disclose their finances. It's very complicated. This is my management style. I would like to be known as a son of encouragement. I have been crucified with Christ. The life I live because Christ lives in me. The life I live in the flesh, which involves fusion and federal service, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Thank you.